Chapter 90. Continuing to live at that place? Repeats Mr. Guppy, walking him on again. At what place? That place? Pointing in the direction of the rag and bottle shop. Mr. Guppy nods. Why, I wouldn't pass another night there for any consideration that you could offer me, says Mr. Weevil, haggardly staring. Do you mean it though, Tony? Mean it? Do I look as if I mean it? I feel as if I do. I know that, says Mr. Weevil with a very genuine shudder. Then the possibility or probability for such it must be considered of your never being disturbed in possession of those effects lately belonging to a lone old man who seemed to have no relation in the world, and the certainty of your being able to find out what he really had got stored up there, don't weigh with you at all against last night, Tony, if I understand you, says Mr. Guppy, biting his thumb with the appetite of vexation. Certainly not. Talk in that cool way of a fellow's living there? Cries Mr. Weevil indignantly. Go and live there yourself. Oh, I, Tony, says Mr. Guppy, soothing him. I have never lived there, and couldn't get a lodging there now, whereas you have got one. You are welcome to it, rejoins his friend, and ugh, you may make yourself at home in it. Then you really and truly at this point, says Mr. Guppy, give up the whole thing, if I understand you, Tony? You never, returns Tony with a most convincing steadfastness, said a truer word in all your life. I do. While they are so conversing, a hackney coach drives into the square, on the box of which vehicle a very tall hat makes itself manifest to the public. Inside the coach, and consequently not so manifest to the multitude, though sufficiently so to the two friends, for the coach stops almost at their feet, are the venerable Mr. Smallweed and Mrs. Smallweed, accompanied by their granddaughter Judy. An air of haste and excitement pervades the party, and as the tall hat surmounting Mr. Smallweed the younger alights, Mr. Smallweed the elder pokes his head out of window and bawls to Mr. Guppy, "How did you, sir? How did you? What do Chick and his family want here at this time of the morning, I wonder?" says Mr. Guppy, nodding to his familiar. "My dear sir," cries Grandfather Smallweed, "would you do me a favor? Would you and your friend be so very obliging as to carry me into the public house in the court, while Bart and his sister bring their grandmother along? Would you do an old man that good turn, sir?" Mr. Guppy looks at his friend, repeating inquiringly, "The public house in the court?" And they prepare to bear the venerable burden to the soul's arms. "There's your fare," says the patriarch to the coachman with a fierce grin, and shaking his incapable fist at him. "Ask me for a penny more, and I'll have my lawful revenge upon you. My dear young man, be easy with me, if you please. Allow me to catch you round the neck. I won't squeeze you tighter than I can help. Oh, Lord! Oh, dear me! Oh, my bones! It is well that the soul is not far off, for Mr. Weevil presents an apoplectic appearance before half the distance is accomplished. With no worse aggravation of his symptoms, however, than the utterance of divers croaking sounds expressive of obstructed respiration, he fuels his share of the porterage, and the benevolent old gentleman is deposited by his own desire in the parlor of the soul's arms. Oh, Lord! Gasps Mr. Smallweed, looking about him, breathless, from an armchair. Oh, dear me! Oh, my bones and back! Oh, my aches and pains! Sit down, you dancing, prancing, shambling, scrambling poll parrot! Sit down! This little apostrophe to Mrs. Smallweed is occasioned by a propensity on the part of that unlucky old lady, whenever she finds herself on her feet, to amble about and set to inanimate objects, accompanying herself with a chattering noise, as in a witch dance. A nervous affection has probably as much to do with these demonstrations as any imbecile intention in the poor old woman, but on the present occasion they are so particularly lively in connection with the Windsor armchair, fellow to that in which Mr. Smallweed is seated, that she only quite desists when her grandchildren have held her down in it, her lord in the meanwhile bestowing upon her, with great volubility, the endearing epithet of a pig-headed jackdaw, repeated a surprising number of times. My dear sir, Grandfather Smallweed then proceeds, addressing Mr. Guppy, there has been a calamity here. Have you heard of it, either of you?
Heard of it, sir?
Why, we discovered it.
You discovered it.
You two discovered it.
Bart, they discovered it.
The two discoverers stare at the Smallweeds, who return the compliment.
My dear friends, whines Grandfather Smallweed, putting out both his hands, I owe you a thousand thanks for discharging the melancholy office of discovering the ashes of Mrs. Smallweed's brother.
Eh? Says Mr. Guppy.
Mrs. Smallweed's brother, my dear friend, her only relation.
We were not on terms, which is to be deplored now, but he never would be on terms.
He was not fond of us.
He was eccentric, he was very eccentric. Unless he has left a will, which is not at all likely, I shall take out letters of administration.
I have come down to look after the property. It must be sealed up. It must be protected.
I have come down, repeats Grandfather Smallweed, hooking the air towards him with all his 10 fingers at once, to look after the property.
I think, Small, says the disconsolate Mr. Guppy, you might have mentioned that the old man was your uncle.
You two were so close about him that I thought you would like me to be the same, returns that old bird with a secretly glistening eye.
Besides, I wasn't proud of him.
Besides which, it was nothing to you, you know, whether he was or not, says Judy, also with a secretly glistening eye.
He never saw me in his life to know me, observed Small.
I don't know why I should introduce him, I am sure.
No, he never communicated with us, which is to be deplored, the old gentleman strikes in, but I have come to look after the property, to look over the papers, and to look after the property.
We shall make good our title.
It is in the hands of my solicitor.
Mr. Tulkinghorn, of Lincoln's Inn Fields, over the way there, is so good as to act as my solicitor, and grass don't grow under his feet, I can tell ye.
Crook was Mrs. Smallweed's only brother. She had no relation but Crook, and Crook had no relation but Mrs. Smallweed.
I am speaking of your brother, you brimstone black beetle, that was 76 years of age.
Mrs. Smallweed instantly begins to shake her head and pipe up, 76 pounds 7 and 7 pence. 76,000 bags of money. 76,000,000,000 of parcels of banknotes.
Will somebody give me a quart pot?
Exclaims her exasperated husband, looking helplessly about him, and finding no missile within his reach.
Will somebody oblige me with a spittoon?
Will somebody hand me anything hard and bruising to pelt at her?
You hag, you cat, you dog, you brimstone barker.
Here Mr. Smallweed, brought up to the highest pitch by his own eloquence, actually throws Judy at her grandmother in default of anything else, by butting that young virgin at the old lady with such force as he can muster, and then dropping into his chair in a heap.
Shake me up, somebody, if you will be so good, says the voice from within the faintly struggling bundle into which he has collapsed.
I have come to look after the property.
Shake me up, and call in the police on duty at the next house, to be explained to about the property.
My solicitor will be here presently to protect the property.
Transportation or the gallows for anybody who shall touch the property.
As his dutiful grandchildren set him up, panting, and putting him through the usual restorative process of shaking and punching, he still repeats like an echo, the property.
The property.
Property.
Mr. Weevil and Mr. Guppy look at each other, the former as having relinquished the whole affair, the latter with a discomfited countenance as having entertained some lingering expectations yet. But there is nothing to be done in opposition to the Smallweed interest.
Mr. Tulkinghorn's clerk comes down from his official pew in the chambers to mention to the police that Mr. Tulkinghorn is answerable for its being all correct about the next of kin, and that the papers and effects will be formally taken possession of in due time and course. Mr. Smallweed is at once permitted so far to assert his supremacy as to be carried on a visit of sentiment into the next house, and upstairs into Miss Flight's deserted room, where he looks like a hideous bird of prey newly added to her aviary. The arrival of this unexpected heir soon taking wind in the court still makes good for the soul, and keeps the court upon its mettle. Mrs. Piper and Mrs. Perkins think it hard upon the young man, if there really is no will, and consider that a handsome present ought to be made him out of the estate. Young Piper and young Perkins, as members of that restless juvenile circle which is the terror of the foot passengers in Chancery Lane, crumble into ashes behind the pump, and under the archway all day long, where wild yells and hootings take place over their remains. Little Swills and Miss M. Mulvillison enter into affable conversation with their patrons, feeling that these unusual occurrences level the barriers between professionals and non-professionals. Mr. Boxby puts up the popular song of King Death, with chorus by the whole strength of the company, as the great harmonic feature of the week, and announces in the bill that J.G. B. is induced to do so at a considerable extra expense in consequence of a wish which has been very generally expressed at the bar by a large body of respectable individuals, and in homage to a late melancholy event which has aroused so much sensation. There is one point connected with the deceased upon which the court is particularly anxious, namely, that the fiction of a full-sized coffin should be preserved, though there is so little to put in it. Upon the undertaker's stating in the soul's bar in the course of the day that he has received orders to construct a six-footer, the general solicitude is much relieved, and it is considered that Mr. Smallweed's conduct does him great honor. Out of the court, and a long way out of it, there is considerable excitement too, for men of science and philosophy come to look, and carriages set down doctors at the corner who arrive with the same intent, and there is more learned talk about inflammable gases, and phosphorated hydrogen than the court has ever imagined. Some of these authorities, of course the wisest, hold with indignation that the deceased had no business to die in the alleged manner, and being reminded by other authorities of a certain inquiry into the evidence for such deaths reprinted in the sixth volume of the Philosophical Transactions, and also of a book not quite unknown on English medical jurisprudence, and likewise of the Italian case of the Countess Cornelia Body as set forth in detail by one Bianchini, prebendary of Verona, who wrote a scholarly work or so, and was occasionally heard of in his time as having gleams of reason in him, and also of the testimony of Messrs. Fodier and Meir, two pestilent Frenchmen who would investigate the subject, and further, of the corroborative testimony of Monsieur Lacat, a rather celebrated French surgeon once upon a time, who had the unpoliteness to live in a house where such a case occurred, and even to write an account of it. Still they regard the late Mr. Crook's obstinacy in going out of the world by any such by way as wholly unjustifiable and personally offensive. The less the court understands of all this, the more the court likes it, and the greater enjoyment it has in the stock in trade of the soul's arms. Then there comes the artist of a picture newspaper, with a foreground and figures ready drawn for anything from a wreck on the Cornish coast to a review in Hyde Park or a meeting in Manchester, and in Mrs. Perkins' own room, memorable evermore, he then and there throws in upon the block Mr. Crook's house, as large as life, in fact, considerably larger, making a very temple of it. Similarly, being permitted to look in at the door of the fatal chamber, he depicts that apartment as 3/4 of a mile long by 50 yards high, at which the court is particularly charmed. All this time the two gentlemen before mentioned pop in and out of every house and assist at the philosophical disputations, go everywhere and listen to everybody, and yet are always diving into the soul's parlor and writing with the ravenous little pens on the tissue paper. At last come the coroner and his inquiry, like as before, except that the coroner cherishes this case as being out of the common way, and tells the gentleman of the jury, in his private capacity, that that would seem to be an unlucky house next door, gentlemen, a destined house, but so we sometimes find it, and these are mysteries we can't account for. After which the six-footer comes into action, and is much admired. In all these proceedings Mr. Guppy has so slight a part, except when he gives his evidence, that he is moved on like a private individual, and can only haunt the secret house on the outside, where he has the mortification of seeing Mr. Smallweed padlocking the door, and of bitterly knowing himself to be shut out. But before these proceedings draw to a close, that is to say, on the night next after the catastrophe, Mr. Guppy has a thing to say that must be said to Lady Dedlock. For which reason, with a sinking heart, and with that hangdog sense of guilt upon him which dread and watching enfolded in the soul's arms have produced, the young man of the name of Guppy presents himself at the town mansion at about 7 o'clock in the evening, and requests to see her ladyship. Mercury replies that she is going out to dinner. Don't he see the carriage at the door? Yes, he does see the carriage at the door. But he wants to see my lady too. Mercury is disposed, as he will presently declare to a fellow gentleman in waiting, to pitch into the young man, but his instructions are positive. Therefore he sulkily supposes that the young man must come up into the library. There he leaves the young man in a large room, not over light, while he makes report of him. Mr. Guppy looks into the shade in all directions, discovering everywhere a certain charred and whitened little heap of coal or wood. Presently he hears a rustling. Is it? No, it's no ghost, but fair flesh and blood, most brilliantly dressed. I have to beg your ladyship's pardon, Mr. Guppy stammers, very downcast. This is an inconvenient time, I told you, you could come at any time. She takes a chair, looking straight at him, as on the last occasion. Thank your ladyship. Your ladyship is very affable. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.